I'm Christopher Leighton. This is Open Source. The stories women tell about prison in this mass incarceration era are different, one from another, and from the men's version too.
It's like animalistic living in a society as a whole as women.
I was getting to know myself.
Might not have been mentally ill before you went into prison, but everybody coming out of prison is mentally ill.
So many of the men in prison today have worked the marketing and delivery end of the illegal drug industry. So many of the women are users, finding ways to pay for drug habits rising out of some buried hurt.
I had to self-medicate myself. I used drugs.
The beginning was, smoking weed.
But then when I became addicted to crack cocaine, I stole to make money.
For many people who are suffering with the illness of addiction, it takes you to places that are so incredibly low in your life at times.
I was doing drugs and I was pretty much killing myself.
Before this hour is over, Reverend Liz Walker of Eyewitness News fame on Boston Television will have a word to the wise.
These women, they are trying to tell us something that we really need to hear. Prison is not the answer for all the problems that we have in the world today.
Women talk the miseries of prison time, much as men do. But one surprise in listening to formerly incarcerated women is hearing them speak gratefully for recovery and self-discovery in prison. Neither did I expect them to go to bat for men in prison, as sons, boyfriends, husbands, and parents, who did what it seemed they had to do to feed their families. We're listening intently again to prison stories, a couple of weeks ago from men, this hour from the women's file, from the growth population behind bars. These are three Massachusetts women who did their time and feel a certain urgency about sharing their news.
I'm a product of a broken home. I had a mother that was a workaholic and a father that was an alcoholic. And my mother took on the role as both mother and father.
Denise Lewis was in and out of prison for most of 3 decades, doing a life sentence, as she says, on the installment plan.
But I was one of those rebellious kids that had to find out things on her own the hard way.
Wanda Luna grew up in Framingham with great parents, she said, but still feeling unloved.
Once I had my daughter, I was physically abused by my daughter's father. That drove me to do cocaine. And then after that, I started using heroin. From there on, I've been struggling with it.
Andrea James, from the top of Sugar Hill in Black Roxbury, was middle class or better all the way. Milton Academy and eventually law school until she turned herself in for fraud, for bending the rules against her bank clients in a brisk Roxbury real estate market. She'd grown up with a zeal for social justice. Today, post-prison, she advocates for justice as healing.
By the time I was in the 7th and 8th grade, I started to see a real divide. I mean, I had friends who lived down the street on the other side of Elm Hill who didn't have food to eat, literally. Mm. And the kids in my community were starting down a path to incarceration.
Denise Lewis, Wanda Luna, Andrea James. Such a variety of stories here and people. Take it in 2 stages. What did you learn in prison? We've all seen now President Obama in prison. The Pope went to prison, as if to say that's part of the tour of America nowadays. You better see a prison.
It's funny.
I've never been in a women's prison. I've taught a lot in men's prisons. But, you know, explain to the Martian that just landed. What's it like to be in prison as you've experienced it?
It's an experience that one will never forget, I can tell you that. Being confined, being locked in at nighttime, knowing that you cannot get out of a cell because the door is locked behind you at nighttime, being told when to eat, when to take a shower, just like animalistic living in a society as a whole as women. But I would say it's all in what you make it. Prison life, it isn't good and it isn't bad. You know, I got to learn a lot of things about myself that either I didn't want to look at or I didn't even know I had inside of me.
When you say taught you about yourself, good and bad, like what?
As you mentioned, President Obama, 2008, I was sitting in the women's lower security and watched Obama become president. And I did a lot of criminal thinking because, like I said, I went to prison a lot for larceny, shoplifting, and things of that nature, assault and battery. So it gave me a chance to go to these programs to kind of learn about my attitude, the anger that I had in myself basically revolved around being separated from a parent. You know, like I said, my mother was a single parent. You know, she was my mother and my father. It taught me how to separate the anger that I had toward my father, because I didn't know that my mother and father couldn't get along and they couldn't live together, and we all couldn't live together as a family as a whole. And it just taught me how to channel that anger. You know, be responsible for my own actions and take responsibility for my own actions, regardless whether it was good or bad. But needless to say, I learned a lot about Denise in prison. Sad that I had to leave my family behind, my mother, my sister, my husband. Being incarcerated is a ripple effect, not just for myself, but for people around me that rely on me.
Did you have a substance problem?
At the time, yes, I did. Started out from marijuana to sniffing coke to smoking cocaine. And it got so bad where, you know, when I first started out, I was stealing just as a mechanism and didn't realize that I had what they call kleptomaniaism. I wasn't stealing to gain. I was stealing just to steal to give away. You know, I gave away more than I ever even sold. But then when I became addicted to crack cocaine, I stole to make money. You know what I mean? So it was a difference between the two, and I couldn't separate the two. But I learned my disease was knowing that I can go pick something up with my hands sweaty and clammy, that I can go in the store and get that instant rush, that instant high off of going to get that piece of item out of the store and getting away with it and just giving it away, not even getting the monetary gain from it. That's where it started for me. The addiction part came later, because I had some trauma in my life that I never addressed, that I never even thought it was trauma. Being young as an age, I was sexually molested by a family friend, and from that molestation, being impregnated, that was a skeleton that was in the closet that I never brought up, not until I was like 30 years old and wondering why did I like to get high. I was stuffing something that was trying to get out, and I didn't know how to channel it, so I turned to drugs. I didn't really have no acceptance around it. It took me to have to go to a psychiatrist, a therapist, and talk and talk and medication. And I was self-medicating myself and not using the medication that they were giving me to, you know, to channel this stuff out.
How'd you self-medicate?
I used drugs.
Denise, what was the most constructive, useful thing you learned about yourself or the world in prison?
That I am a woman, a child of God, that has so much to offer another individual, a younger generation up underneath myself, that from my mistakes in my life, someone can take from my mistakes and learn from that and go on and don't have to repeat the mistakes that I made in my life. I'm a woman that has more experience and more knowledge in more areas in my life that I even thought that I even ever had. Right now, I'm getting ready to go to school for culinary arts so that I can open up my own business, something that I've been wanting to do all my life and just was too busy, you know, taking care of this person and taking care of that person when I needed to be taking care of myself. I'm a person that's open, willing to help anybody. That's the person that I am today. And I'm learning that there's another world out there besides crime and drugs, alcohol, abuse.
Wanda Luna, I want to know what were the lessons of prison for you. But first, just connect with Denise. I mean, what rings a bell in her story?
Pretty much everything she said. Like, my blessing was that day that they kicked my door open and arrested me and took me to prison. For me, it saved my life, because I was doing drugs and I was pretty much killing myself. Not just hurting me, but hurting the people that loved me, the people that I love. So for me, it was a blessing. The only time that I would get clean would always have to be, you know, going to jail, going to prison. And I come out and I go back to the drugs and continue that cycle. And
was it cold turkey in prison? Did you have counseling? Did you have treatment?
Cold turkey. I mean, they have, what do they call it, comfort meds.
What's a comfort med? We don't mean methadone.
No, they don't give you methadone. They give only methadone to the women that are pregnant. Comfort meds are like Librium, Tylenol, Motrin, nothing that's going to help you. Well, it didn't help me.
What about your sleep?
Oh, it took me maybe like a whole month before I could really actually get a good night's sleep.
Mm.
It was horrible. But this last time, I said something's got to change. And
you said?
Yeah, to myself, because I didn't want to live like that no more. And my daughter, I have a 17-year-old daughter right now, and I remember on Mother's Day, she was under DCF custody. And I remember my lawyer coming up to me in the cell and telling me, you know, your daughter's fine. She wants to wish you a happy Mother's Day. And then they told me, you know, your daughter got pregnant under DCF custody. And I think that's when I said, you know what, I can't live like this no more, you know, because my daughter was out on a run and now she's pregnant.
Out on a run meaning?
When I got incarcerated, she just ran off. She wanted to be with me and I wasn't there. So she would run away and, you know, start smoking weed and, you know, thank God that it didn't go bad, you know, worse. And I remember my DCF worker coming to the cell and telling me, listen, she's pregnant. I'm scared because what about if she has this baby? She's been on the run. So, you know, you need to get it together. And I, right then and there in that courthouse, in that cell, that holding, I got on my knees and I just asked God, listen, take control because I can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I remember my DCF worker telling me, you know what? When you're asked to do something and you don't want to do it, that's when you should do it.
Do it anyway.
Yes, do it anyway. And that's going to help you. And it's exactly what I did. Mm. That's exactly what I did. I mean, this is my life. I'm not going to say that I regret everything. I regret some of it. But I like the saying, what doesn't kill you only makes you stronger. Mm-hmm. And I truly believe that. I have a grandbaby that is my everything. I'll just look at his picture and I'll just start crying because...
Let's all cry.
He motivates me. And I also have a son that's 8 years old. I just feel so good. Like... I love being sober, and I can have a good time. I just went to my nephew's wedding, and I had such a great time without drinking or doing anything. So, you know, that gives me more motivation. You know, I can have fun without any substance. Mm-hmm. So that's where I'm at.
Wanda Luna, Andrea James, and Denise Lewis are sharing their prison stories. Coming up, more on the conflicted feelings here. Women saying that an ugly, awful intervention that got you sober, gave you time to find yourself, cannot be all bad. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source.
I'll get out of all your boxes. I'll get out. You can't hold me in these chains, I'll get out. Father, free me from this bondage. Knowing my condition is the reason I must change.
We're listening to Women Out of Prison, and already you can hear a paradox. Wanda Luna was just saying she's alive and well because cops kicked her door open one day and took her to a perfectly awful time of reckoning in prison.
So it is true that for many people who are suffering with the illness of addiction, that it takes you to places that are so incredibly low in your life at times, and the pain is so incredibly great that it might have been the best day in your life, in your experience, for somebody to come and take you to prison. But unfortunately, that is true, because in this country, that's the default for the illness of incarceration.
Absolutely.
So it's not that it's the best answer, but you will over and over and over again hear the same stories, particularly from women, because women aren't given the support that they need to overcome some very difficult trauma in their lives that many women who, if you look at the profile of incarcerated women, began to experience at very young ages. Mm-hmm. And that leads to, ultimately, their self-medication, their reliance upon drugs to feel better. Mm. So I think that it's very important that when we talk about the very, very, very real experience mm-hmm. of going to prison and feeling like, oh my God, thank you, only separating me from being able to be on the street with this drug is going to get me enough space to get sober again. And that could very well be true. But what we have to understand as a country, and policymakers and legislators have to get to the core of, is that people need help. People need to heal. People need treatment. It's like having cancer, and we say to the person who has cancer, we're not going to treat you. We're going to let you just be sick. We're not going to give you the help that you need. We're not going to give you any chemo. We're not going to do any of the natural homeopathic stuff that is the real way to help people begin to heal. Because there's just as many women that doors were kicked in and who were taken to prison. But guess what? They relapsed when they came home because we don't have the system in place the way it should be in place. Women should not have to wait until they're incarcerated, sitting on their knees, separated from their children in a jail cell before they start to get the support that they need if they're suffering from the illness of addiction.
No, I hear you. It's an important point. It's a kind of salvation for some people, but it's a salvation by default when all sorts of other remedies.
And isn't that a shame?
You're speaking of prison as a kind of meat cleaver treatment applied mainly to poor people. Is that your understanding too, Wanda?
Yes. I mean, it makes sense, everything she's saying. It makes sense. I mean, for me, I don't know any other way, or I can't think of any other way that I would have gotten it together.
Would you have ever volunteered for treatment if somebody said, you got a problem, Wanda, and let's deal with it?
Yes. But then I do treatment, and then I get on methadone for 5 days, they lower my dosage, but then I would leave and just start using again. My experience incarcerated, I felt like I really sat down and thought about everything that I was doing, all the people that I was hurting. I was getting to know myself, know who Wanda is. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not saying, all right, let's put women in prison. No, that's not what I'm saying. For me, you know, but also, if I got the help that I really needed way before, maybe I would have never gotten to that.
What we're talking about here is it's not just the illness of addiction. It's the stigma that comes along with it. And it's all the other things that are unsupported when you talk about, well, why wouldn't somebody go for treatment? Because it's not consistent. It's not built in to how our society deals with that kind of particular illness. It's not ongoing. It's hard to find it. There's a stigma that's attached to it that will keep particularly a mother from actually going to try and get the help she needs because she is going to be faced with the probability of losing her children, of being separated from her children. One of the things that you talked about, Chris, was what is it about women and being in prison together? There's a sisterhood in prison. And if you walk into any women's prison in the country, you will feel a heaviness in the air Absolutely. That you don't feel anywhere else. And that heaviness comes from the separation of these women from their loved ones and from their families, the separation of mothers from their children. And if you ever were in prison, particularly if you've ever been a mother in prison, you understand firsthand how alarming that is. Most people, most mothers, could hardly ever imagine what it is like to be separated from your children. Now, if you're a woman who's been incarcerated, that's a punishment. But then in addition to that punishment is the layover of being separated from your children. And people have this idea that because you send a woman to prison, oh, life is going to get great for her, and she's going to come out, and everything's going to be roses, right? That's absolutely not what happens. Prison most times makes that experience of going to prison more difficult for women to come out, get back on their feet, and do all the things that they could have done with the support without adding the layer of repeating this with yet another generation of our children that go through this cycle because they have been separated from their mothers for incarceration.
You speak about a bonding, also of a heaviness. Is this different from the solidarity or lack of it that men experience in prison and out of it?
Oh, I'm sure it is, because prison is a place where you bond with people and you rely on people to survive. and to feed you and to help you and to be there with you when you get on the telephone, if you can afford the phone call, and hear bad news from home or hear your children.
It's completely different from men. With women, you have women that have been in prison 30, 40 years mm-hmm. now that aren't leaving prison. And you as a newcomer, you have some of those women that have been there for so long can guide you through. Listen, you're young, you got these babies, you need to get in here and you need to focus on these parenting programs for you to have your kids. You have women that come in, you know, their children are in DSS custody and they need to get those children with their parents instead of being in foster homes. You have these long-term lifers that have been in prison and take you under their wing and help you and show you and guide you to the direction where you need, opposed to men. I'm not going to say all men, I'm going to say most men, they go to prison, they don't have to worry about children. If they do have children, that's not their first thought. Oh, are my kids okay? Or are my kids with their parent, with their mother, or with their aunt, their uncle, whomever taking care of their children? That's not their first thought that comes to their minds. You know, opposed to women, women have children. That's the first thought that comes to their mind. I'm going to lose my mind. I'm here without my kids. My kids are not here. Who's going to take care of my kids? My kids are being mistreated, this, that, and the third. Women that are in prison help other women. They come to them as a bond and say, listen, you know, we can't tell you what to, we can't make you do these things. We can only suggest, you know, you take these steps because I did this, 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 and this, and it got me this, 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 and this. Women incarcerated, it's a bad thing, but it's also a good thing. Myself, I don't have any children, but I still have my nieces, my nephews, and my mother, and my husband, and everybody else looking to me, and I'm not there. You know, I still yearned and cried every night, just like a mother that had children, because I was away from my husband. I was away from my nieces and nephews who I helped rear up as children as well.
It sounds like a very big difference. I mean, the cliche at least is that guys go to prison to become more advanced criminals and learn more tricks of more trades. You're talking about a very different kind of bonding.
Because it's a different kind of system for women as it is for men.
Is it the system or is it sisterhood?
It's more sisterhood in women's prison than it is for a manhood in a man's prison.
The reasons why the majority of women are in prison are different than with men. The most damage they're causing is to themselves.
Right.
There are reasons that stem from, again, needing to heal, and sometimes from very early stages of their lives. And that's different. So when you get
I've seen numbers that say 20% of the women in prison are there for a violent crime, 40% related to drugs and a variety of other things. But how do you work with that?
The majority of women that are incarcerated anywhere in this country, county or state or federal, are there for nonviolent offenses. We don't really differentiate between violent and nonviolent, because to really understand why people do the things that they do, you don't start with trying to help them to heal by saying you committed an armed robbery as opposed to you sold drugs, right? Because the underlying issues that get everybody engaged in being justice involved are all the same. So we can't start saying you're more worthy because you only smoke crack and sold drugs, as opposed to somebody who might have beat up somebody or did some property crime, whatever it is. It's all still related to the things that have caused pain in people.
You're right.
Hurt people hurt people.
It's that underlying layer of pain that they covered up that is the whole issue. You know, have they gotten some help under that layer? You know, a lot of the things later on in life would be less. You know, like you said, for myself, for the issue that happened to me as a kid, had I had the help addressing all of that, you know, a lot of the things that went on in my life would not have ever taken place.
How many of you know men who've done time?
My daughter's father did 10 years for attempted murder, came out of prison, didn't even last one full year out in the street, and now he's back for 12 years.
Denise?
I have a family member that's been incarcerated. He's in the state of California. He started out here in Massachusetts with, what do they call it now, human trafficking. Back then it was white slavery. He's been incarcerated from here to California and gotten out on that long stint of parole and always turning back to prison. So,
Andrea?
I know quite a few men in my community that have been incarcerated. I'm also married to a man who served a 10-year federal mandatory minimum drug sentence. Mm-hmm. That was 27 years ago. There were numerous members of his family that continue to be incarcerated even on that same case. So,
but here's my question. We've just well begun listening to men's stories. I wonder what you make of the men's story of their plight.
We deindustrialized this nation. We sent jobs away. We closed factories. Even if a person did not, again, have a professional degree, they could make a good living working at one of the motor companies, working on an assembly line, working in a textile company. Mm-hmm. There were jobs. There were ways that people could make money to feed their families. And when people can't do that, which is what happened when they started to just eliminate those kinds of manual labor jobs, you created this vast swath of people who already were undereducated, so they couldn't spin off easily into the high-tech job sector. And it created a lot of people who didn't have work. And poor people have to eat, too.
That's right.
And poor people love their children and love their families like everybody else does, too. Yeah, so people will create an economy where an economy doesn't exist. You would do it. Everybody in the studio would do it if their children are hungry. And see, one of the things in defense of the men that I have to say is that during these decades of this war on drugs, and somehow mysteriously we didn't have any jobs, but drugs flooded our inner city communities. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, just drugs were just everywhere. And now guns are just everywhere. Mm-hmm. And somehow that just happened. But during that time, when there was no traditional job sector in our communities, the men did create ways to generate revenue and to feed their families. And they were painted, though, predominantly Black and Latino men, as bad fathers because they would go out onto the block and they would sell drugs and they would make some money and they would take care of the family and pay the rent and do all these things up until the time that they were incarcerated. And the sanctions were ramped up and they were gone for longer and longer periods of time. But they weren't bad fathers. They weren't bad fathers. They cared about their children. They did what they could to take care of their children. Poverty is real in this country. I speak to a lot of people in a lot of communities across this country, and a lot of them don't quite understand what it means to not have any money. They can't wrap their heads around there's a woman sitting somewhere on Humboldt Avenue in an apartment, and she has no money.
Right.
She's got like 7 cents sitting on the kitchen table, and she's got all of these needs. That's real. And the consequences of returning home from prison, where you now are barred from a job, felony convictions, you're not getting a job, you're not getting an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
You can't live in public housing. Women have always been the backbones of families. We were always the ones, our grandmothers, our mothers, at home waiting if somebody had to take a fall, whatever kind of fall it is. The women were always the ones there. Mothers weren't allowed to let their sons move back into their apartments. They would lose their driver's license. Nothing to do with driving under the influence. Uh-uh. But somehow, for years, the Registry of Motor Vehicles took your license from you if you had a drug conviction.
I can testify.
And you had to pay thousands of dollars and wait a period of up to 5 years before you became eligible.
Yes.
Fines, penalties, sanctions, can't get housing, can't get assistance with food, can't get a job, can't get a license to be a barber, you know, lost your rights to make an earning, completely having the necessary pieces to a thriving community pulled out from underneath you. And then every time you recidivated and went back, you went for a longer period of time.
Yes.
That decimates a community. That's what we've seen, and that's what we're experiencing with the men. And now, women are the fastest growing incarceration population. Mm-hmm.
Denise, I want your take on the men's predicament and their stories. Do you believe them?
Yes, I do. Because as Andrea said, the world crashed around the jobs and jobs were being lost and the jobs were taken from here to China. People were out of work. You know, people had to make ends meet. And men, being men as being from our generation, were the sole provider. They did what they had to do. If they didn't clean people's yards or if they didn't work on people's cars, they turned to selling drugs. And it went from getting that money, things going good, everybody's provided for, to being incarcerated because they broke the law by selling drugs, you know, and not once but twice. And it gets worse and the time grows, goes from 3 to 5 years to 5 to 10 years to 10 to 15 years to what do they call it now? Career criminal. And as Andrea said, we as women were the backbone. When something happened and they lost that housing, we were able to take on that role and responsibility. But today, that's not happening because, like she said, a mother loses her son to drugs. She can't have her son come back in her apartment because she's going to lose her housing because she's living in a federally funded or state funded housing program. And if she puts him into her house, she's going to be put out on the street too. And it's not right. But that's what the world has come to now. So my take on it is this. It's not right that they have to do what they have to do to provide for their family, but I applaud them because they made the effort to try to do what they needed to do. I don't think it's right that they turned to drugs and crime and whatever else they had to do, but them being as men, they said they felt like if it wasn't that, they felt like they weren't a man, that their manhood was being challenged. So they did what they had to do. You know, no, it's not right what they did, but I applaud them for at least stepping up to the plate to try to be accountable for their family. Coming to you loud and clear. Like to bring everyone's attention.
We're listening to Survivor's Tales from women representing the growth population in this 40-year era of mass incarceration in America. Coming up, a tangle of feeling among these women around men in prison, serving longer sentences in much larger numbers. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Prison Tales this hour from formerly incarcerated women. Andrea James, who did 2 years for fraud, Wanda Luna, many years for drug addiction, Denise Lewis, multiple short sentences for larceny and assault and battery, among other things. 2 weeks ago, men out of prison gave us their versions of being driven into crime, especially the drug trade, to pay rent and feed their women and kids. I had been dying to get the women's take on that line. I find this just completely interesting that you are going to bat for the men. We heard these stories. Mm-hmm. The worst thing about prison was being without their children. Somebody's got to put food on the table. Somebody's got to pay grandma's rent and will do what has to be done, that kind of thing. And I frankly wondered, you know, are they being kind to themselves or making this up? Would their women agree? It sounds as if you're confirming the view of the men. Do you wonder?
Yeah, and not just that. Like, my daughter's father, I truly, truly, truly believe that he's institutionalized. You know, because he was incarcerated for so long that he doesn't know how to live any other way. Mm. When he first got out of prison, he tried to get a job. He could not get a job. So it led to him dealing drugs. Mm. And he ended up back in prison. I remember when he got out of prison, my daughter wanted to do a lot of things. And, you know, I would always make sure, you know, I had money for the kids and everything. But he, when he got out, he started feeling bad because he couldn't provide for them. So it led him to deal drugs. And I remember her begging him, my daughter begging her father, please, Papi, please spend some time with me. Why do you always have to be outside? And it was because he was out there hustling to provide for our kids. It was the saddest thing ever. And I even went up to him and told him, listen, she's worried. She wants her dad. You weren't there for 10 years of her life. Like, she wants you. He's like, yeah, but, you know, I need to make sure that you guys are okay.
And I think one of the things that we need to add to that is how incredibly dehumanizing incarceration is, right? And so in addition to coming out and having that stigma and having the record and not getting anybody who will give you a job, give you a chance, also not getting a job that is a dignified wage, which is another problem, because minimum wage is not going to give this man enough money to pay the rent, feed his family. And if you can get a job that will even give you 40 hours a week, it's very difficult. And then if you don't have a lot of education, it gets worse. And add to that now what people don't think about. When we're released from prison, we're expected to walk out the front gate and start jumping through all the hoops, pee in the cup for the probation officer, go and fill out job applications, and go and try and find housing, and go and try and get our kids back, and jump through the DCF hoops, and all this stuff, okay? And we are absolutely exhausted, because even if you go to jail and sleep every single day in prison, the environment in itself is dehumanizing and it is exhausting. And you are hypervigilant. You are always trying to stay on top of what's going on around you. And you're emotionally exhausted, because if you live for any period of time where you are constantly stuffing down the feelings inside of you, just stuffing, stuffing, you're might not have been mentally ill before you went into prison, but everybody coming out of prison is mentally ill. So, so in addition to that, now you bring anybody, man or woman, into a household where other people now are responsible for taking care of you. You can't even buy your own soap.
That's right.
You gotta hope that somebody's there to help you out. And then you start to feel like an already stretched family, a family that already is having a hard time making ends meet. And now you're really a drain on that family, because people are glad to see you. They loved you. They missed you. But when you get into the everyday routine of what life is like, when you don't have something and you need to produce something, the pressure will build. And I think it's even more the case with men.
Can I ask, is the recidivism rate among women anything like as high as among men?
Yeah, everybody. 50% across the board in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Interesting. So what are the big differences, if any, between the reentry experience of women and of men?
I speak from experience with the recidivism. I did life sentence on an installment plan. I started out going to prison when I was 22 years old. Just seemed like I'd get out, I'd do good, and I'd catch a case and I'd go back to jail. I'd get out, I'd do good, I'd catch a case, I'd go back to jail. And it went on from the age of 22 till I finally got it when I was 49 years old. And here we're talking some 27 years now. And this is what I'm saying to you. I did the life on installment plan. For me, this go round, I just said enough is enough. You know, I have no mother. I have no father. All I have is my sister and brothers. You know, they got their own life. And then I got this husband that, you know, is mad as hell at me because I went back to jail from hustling, going back out in them stores doing what I'm supposed to do, knowing that if they catch me, it's going to get worse. And knowing that if they catch me this third time, being not a second or third or fourth subsequent, that I'm at the career criminal level now where I can go to jail for 20 to 30 years for the crime that I'm committing, because I've passed the stage of second and third and fourth and fifth offense, you know. And now if they catch me this time, you know, the judge can give me whatever the judge wants to give me. But today, 2015, Denise is going back to jail. Denise learned the new way to reach out for help and ask for help. I'm reaching out for what I need to do. I'm going to school for culinary arts. I'm searching, you know, anything that's going to help me to stay free from prison. And I'm loving it, because once upon a time, there weren't a lot of resources for women. When I first got out of jail back in the 90s, they had no programs for women that you can go to. Yeah, you can go to the probation department, and they'll send you to a literacy group that you went to every other Wednesday at a college, and you just read books and you discussed them. That's as far as it went. Now, today, 2015, they have so much more for a woman to gain access and to bettering herself opposed to years ago. So it's a beautiful thing.
Can I just say something again real quick about that, about the stigma? If a guy goes and sells drugs and uses drugs and gets caught and goes to prison, he's a guy, right? If a woman does it, there's so much more of a stigma attached to that, particularly if she's a mother. Instantly, immediately, she's a bad mother, right? She could have been the best mother on the planet, but she's a bad mother. If a woman goes to prison for prostitution, it instantly puts a profile, a picture, a stigma against that person that men, quite honestly, they're almost, unfortunately, they're tough. They're, you know, these brave guys. Women
well, yes
are
or no.
diminished to portraits of these very horrible people when they go to prison and for the things that, many of them go for.
But there's also this wild generalization that men in prison are bad, women in prison are sick. Where did that come from? And
I don't know, because they're not...
There's men that are very sick also, so...
Yeah. And there are some bad women.
Right. Absolutely.
But if that's what... I mean, I don't know where that came from, because they're certainly not treating the women like they're sick. Women are the fastest growing incarceration population. Mm-hmm. If they thought they were sick, they'd be trying to help them.
Liz Walker has been listening to all of this with me. The legendary TV news anchor in Boston. She's now Reverend Liz Walker, pastor at the Roxbury Presbyterian Church, with a strong interest in addressing all kinds of hidden injury, trauma in her community.
I was spellbound listening to these women, and I think they are sounding an alarm. They are trying to tell us something that we really need to hear. Prison is not the answer for all the problems that we have in the world today. Which your guests said very eloquently, Wanda, Andrea, and Denise have all said this. People need help more than they need to be locked away. So I guess the alarm is that if we keep doing this, I mean, we're only making it worse. People go into prison and then they come out and they're bigger problems. Most times you have recidivism. You have people going back into it. It's just a cycle because they have no support.
Not to mention planting a new generation of kids who've grown up 2, 3, 5 years before they see their mama.
It's awful.
And the women suffering terribly.
And then that new generation just does the same thing. And it's a cycle.
I think it's almost beyond dispute that too many women are going to jail, and especially drug addicts, whose major crime is victimizing themselves. Do you have an idea of why we're doing it more than before?
I think that there's a zero tolerance kind of tone that's been set in our country, and people are not able to show grace to each other. We're not able to forgive. We're not able to give each other breaks. I think it's also because, you know, the economy is such that there's not the resources, and people can't really reach out maybe like they want to because there's not the resources. But I also think that because a lot of us are seeing it as somebody else's problem. And I say this as a representative of the religious community. This is our problem. But churches close their doors to this. And most institutions are closing their doors to this, except for prisons. And they're privatized, so somebody's trying to make a dime out of that. So it's a mess that we've created for ourselves as a society. And that's why I think we have to stop the cycle, particularly around women. Because they shouldn't be in prison. They should be getting help. They should definitely be taking responsibility for their mistakes and their problems. They should learn responsibility of being parents. I mean, so there's lots of things that have to happen. But I'm not so sure that mass incarceration has ever been the right answer. I thought it was really interesting that these women talked about how prison for them, the three of them, was sort of this salvific experience, that they actually were able to turn their lives around. And what I got out of that is, if they could do that in prison, if they had some support, what could they do? You know, if they had programs to help them, if they had programs in schools to help them. And I know there are plenty of people out there who are trying to do the right thing, but not enough.
So many threads here. Racism, deindustrialization, on which Andrew was eloquent, joblessness, drugs in the community, trauma, absent parents. I mean, where do you begin?
To me, it's about developing community around not just the best of our children, the best of our who we are, but it's developing community around our challenges. And I think that's what is not happening. We are allowing these kinds of issues to divide us. And this is exactly the thing that should bring us together as a community. Because we're only as strong as our weakest link. I don't know who said that, but somebody incredibly smart said that. So if we're not taking care of our elderly, if we're not taking care of our children, and if we're not taking care of our sick, then we're not doing a good job as a society. And I would argue that drug addiction is as much an illness as it is a social problem.
Liz Walker, you have a trauma center at the Roxbury Presbyterian Church where you pastor. I'd love to hear about it.
I worked in Sudan for 11 years. I've got to tell you, it's like living in a war zone. But I saw it in the faces of people walking up and down. I saw it in the streets, the people in my church. And we wanted to do something about it. You know, trauma is about unemployment. Trauma is racism. There's lots of reasons that people are in pain. So we decided that the first thing we could do, the simplest thing, was to offer people in our neighborhood, whether they were church people or not, the opportunity to talk about their pain.
Interesting, partly because of the women who've been talking to us, they spoke directly of trauma and the deep unhealed injury that gets self-medicated, that becomes a drug problem, becomes addiction, becomes incarceration. So we're right
there. If you can't let it out, if you can't release it, if you hide it, if there's a stigma about what happened to you.
Right. Denise spoke of burying the memory of a friend of the family abusing her, impregnating her as a child into her 30s. It was a hot stove she could not even think of touching.
I think that kind of trauma is shared by so many people. And I don't think that's something
that Freud said.
It's not limited to any economic level or social level. We all walk around with secrets. These women are wonderful, all that they're saying, but they're out there trying to do it on their own right now. They all need counseling. They need to be allowed to cry. They need to be allowed to mourn. Everybody's not strong. Add to that mix poverty. Add to that mix racism. You know, it's just the constant day-to-day living in a community where you're not quite in control like maybe other communities. There's a constant notion or feeling of lack of control and pain around that. But I see it all the time. Standing in line, waiting on the bus, waiting on getting service. I mean, anything can trigger people who are in pain anyway and don't feel that anybody cares. They feel they're invisible. The young men are angry. There's a lot of that going on. Most of the people in my community are wonderful people, but there are a lot of people in pain.
Thank you, Liz Walker. I asked Denise, Andrea, and Wanda for last words about where they are today and who they thank along the way back. I mean, I wonder who in your lives individually you feel you owe for kindness or maybe tough love or inspiration or example. Or
I pay first respect to God, but secondly, my niece and my nephew, the ones that I raised. They're 36 and 40 years old now. They always love me no matter what. You know what I mean? And in regards to going to jail and stuff, you know, they would take my calls. If I asked them to do something for me or take care of something for me, they always did that. So, you know, I'm grateful to those kids because they got me through this prison sentence. I'm grateful for my husband because I'm always a one. You know, he kind of pushed me to get away from the things because he would always constantly remind me, well, you know, if you go to jail, you know, your time is going to get harder and harder and harder. You know, I was grateful for the judge. And if I knew his name right now, I would tell everybody and would tell him thank you because he could have gave me a sentence that was stiffer than what he gave me. So I'm grateful for that, too.
Mm-hmm. Andrea, your turn.
I'm incredibly grateful for my upbringing. I came from an incredible family that instilled in us social justice and the history of Black people in this country, which helped me to understand exactly what I was witnessing when I walked in to that federal prison for women and looked across a sea of Black and Latino women. And it helped me to understand how it came to be that way. And in terms of my survival through the experience of being incarcerated, you know, my husband, who knew very much what I was about to go through, he also, again, did federal time, and he did a lot more than I did. He served a 10-year mandatory sentence. So he was there and drove 3 hours there and 3 hours back every single weekend. Our youngest child was 6 months old when I left them in the parking lot of the federal prison and went and walked in to start my time. My son didn't really know what mommy was, but he knew I was the mommy lady. Mm-hmm. And so it was only because of my husband understanding the absolute importance of supporting a person during and through incarceration and having children understand where they come from. I'm incredibly grateful for his love and his support.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I'm glad to be here. This actually helped me. having this conversation helped me.
I have to really say it was an honor and a privilege mm-hmm. to be given the opportunity to speak out as a woman for life after incarceration. It's given me a chance to, you know, see things a little differently and help another individual that's either going through or heading in that direction or coming from that direction.
Andrea James, Denise Lewis, Wanda Luna, thank you so much. We're very, very grateful.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Liz Walker. Thanks also to the team at SPAN Incorporated who helped us with this story. SPAN is a nonprofit supporting formerly incarcerated Bostonians with case management, health services, career development, and counseling support. Check them out at SPAN, Inc., SPANINC.org. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Max Larkin, Pat Tomino, and Zach Goldhammer. George Hicks recorded and mixed our conversations. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time right here on Open Source.